Oh, wow. So you know Miss Jones?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I do.
She was divine.
Hi, y'all. Today on Bus Ride Talks, we're speaking with Gerard Taylor, actor, director, and educator, as well as associate artistic director at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company in Baltimore. We talk about his path from neuroscience to the arts, approaching the classics without the white gaze, and the oh-so-small world of PG County. If you know, you know.
Hi, Gerard. We are with you today. We also have Tim, who's joining us on part of this conversation. But how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. It's what, 10 o'clock in the morning? So I'm just starting my day. Nothing to complain about yet.
Yeah, 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. Not too much happening yet. So yeah. Are you, I know you're DMV based. Are you, what part of the DMV are you in currently, or are you in Baltimore right now?
Yeah, I'm currently living in Baltimore. I moved to the city just before the pandemic last year.
Ooh.
So I got here in February, and then in March we were all quarantining. So
that, okay, I don't want to divert so soon, but actually I am really invested in everyone who moved right before this happened, because I had a couple months where I was living at home, and then I moved out with my roommate in January. Okay. So we had time to like get settled and be used to this before March happened. But everyone who like moved in February, moved in early March, what was that experience? Like, were you completely new to Baltimore, or did you know a little bit about it? How did that go with like the shutdown coming so soon after moving?
Well, so I'm from PG County.
Yes! I'm so excited.
So I, yeah.
So excited. Oh my God, yes.
So, you know, I grew up in Maryland, and then I went to undergrad at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. So, you know, I've been in and around the city frequently my entire life. So I'm no stranger to it. But, you know, I was a little bit excited because I was moving to the Mount Vernon area, which,
it's pretty.
You know, it is. And I sort of like just the energy of this neighborhood. There's a bunch of bars. There's a bunch of shops. There's a lot of things to do. A lot of small businesses and restaurants. There was a record store a couple of blocks up that I was excited about because I love, you know, old things. And anyway, so I moved here, and then everything shut down within a couple of weeks. And now a lot of those businesses have closed. You know, Grand Central was a big gay bar right up the street here, and that closed within months. The Charm City Cafe, the City Cafe is closed. There was a great Thai food place right down the street. They used to sell this. Like a shrimp fried rice inside of pineapple.
Oh,
and I love that. And that place is shut down. So anyway, it's been quiet for the past year, but hopefully, in the next few months, things will start to open up and we'll have a little bit more energy down here again, but we'll see.
Yeah. No, that's so interesting because you move with such an expectation of like all these places and then it just shifts completely.
Yeah, well, there are worse things in life, you know. at least I have a home over my head with, you know, with running water and electricity and heat. So I can be grateful for that. I think the pandemic... Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think the pandemic has hit a lot of people very hard, and I've been lucky enough to survive.
Yeah, I really feel that. I think one of the things that is like a miracle about GCC is the fact that we really started this. I know at some point Tim and I looked at each other, and we were just like, you know, we're doing this now, and like all of the times to be like starting something. But it also, I think, at least for me, it was really nice to have something that was starting in the midst of like all these other things that were either stopped or stopping.
No, yeah, definitely. And I mean, what better time, you know? I think we find ourselves with a new outlook, a new perspective on the world and on life, and this is a perfect time to start new endeavors, new organizations, new community building, all of that stuff.
Yeah, Gerard,
Yeah,
you
I'm
just
actually grateful to hear that. Tim, go ahead.
started a new project with Chesapeake Shakespeare Company, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, a year ago, I guess it's a little less than a year, but this past summer, with all of the Black Lives Matters protests happening across the world, and we see White American Theater, I think there was a desire at CSC to reevaluate the culture at CSC specifically, but also just sort of the culture of theater, and what can we do to better to provide better access to our Black populations, our Black actors and artists, our Black communities and patrons. Baltimore is a city with a close to 70% Black population. So, that is the majority here. And as a theater, I always like my buddy down at the Old Globe. He says theater is a community service, right? Just like a mayor, right, or a president who we vote into office to do this a service for us, or a police commissioner, or a firefighter, right? These are all people giving things back to the community in service of a community, right? And theaters serve the same purpose. We're here for the people, right, in the community that we serve. So, being a theater in Baltimore, I just don't think you can get around the fact that the majority of your population are Black people. And then on top of that, there's an even larger a people of color population here, right? So, anyways, that's a long way of saying the theater company got together and said, okay, well, what can we do to better engage with our Black artists? And we put together a committee to kind of look at what's happening here at CSC, here in Baltimore, across the world, and what can we do better? And so we put together what we've called the Black Classical Acting Ensemble at Chesapeake Shakespeare Company, which is an ensemble of Black actors across, most of them are local to Baltimore or the Baltimore region. We do have a few members of the ensemble that are from New York, or we've got a guy out in Memphis, Tennessee. But the ensemble was basically put together to reevaluate how we talk about Shakespeare and the classics, how we teach Shakespeare and the classics, how we train in Shakespeare and the classics, and how we perform how we perform Shakespeare and the classics to make this old white man cis straight, or at least as far as we know about him, right? To make this old antique person valuable to the 21st century, across Maryland, students are reading Romeo and Juliet in the 7th, 8th, 9th grades, right? When I was in school in Prince George's County, we read Romeo and Juliet, Taming of the Shrew, Comedy of Errors, Hamlet, Julius Caesar. That's a lot of plays from one playwright, you know? We read zero plays by, or we read zero pieces of work by Maya Angelou, right? We read zero pieces of work by Toni Morrison, who now that I'm older, have become some of my favorite narratives. So, what is it about Shakespeare that's so important to us? Why Shakespeare? Why Shakespeare today? Why Shakespeare in Baltimore City? Why Shakespeare in this community of mostly black people? You know, what does he have to say to us? And what do we have to learn from him? So the ensemble has been working over the over this year, in sort of reevaluating what we're doing with Shakespeare in Baltimore. We had a retreat weekend, I guess three weeks ago now, where we brought in some instructors from around the world. We had a hip hop theater or a hip hop Shakespeare teacher come in from Seattle, Washington. We had a griot from London, and this is all on Zoom, thankfully, right? So there's a thing we could do during the pandemic. We don't have to worry about airfare, right? So we had a griot from London. We had a teacher from Webster University in St. Louis, and then another teacher from the Brown Trinity rep, and they all came in and introduced us to alternative ways of approaching Shakespeare, non-Eurocentric ways of approaching Shakespeare, right?
I love that.
What are some African tools of acting, and how can we use them when we pick up a Shakespeare play? How can we use them when we teach a Shakespeare play in the classroom, and so on and so forth. So, you know, right now we're still in the exploration stage of how we can change the culture of Shakespeare at CSC. And hopefully, you know, with a few more retreats and a lot more discussion, we'll have a better grasp on that.
That is super impressive. That's a lot of work to get done in this time.
Yeah, well, like I was saying about this organization, you know, what better time? We're sitting around, we're thinking a little bit differently. We're seeing things that have been in the shadows for so long, and now are come to light. And I think, you know, something about this generation, the millennials, which I'm a part of, and then the generations after me, I think we've been told for so long to just wait and things will get better, right? Just be patient and wait and wait and wait. And I think everyone is tired of waiting. You know, we've been waiting for change for I God since 1777. So you know, I think now is the perfect time to stand up and say, okay, great, we waited, that was fine. Now let's see what active steps we can take to change things. And I think we see it all over. A few years ago, when all of the Brett Kavanaugh thing happened, and then all of these women were coming out about how they had been abused by men of power, and then we said, okay, in the theater, we said, okay, there needs to be an intimacy director to be there to look out and make sure that people aren't being abused, right?
Yeah.
If there are moments of sex, this is a formal, responsible way of handling it. If there are, there shouldn't just be a director in the room with actors just running roughshod, right? How irresponsible is that?
Yeah.
Just looking at things more responsibly. And I think we've got to do the same thing with issues of race. We've got to do the same thing with issues of sexuality and gender identity. I think that, one thing, I'm actually writing an article about this, but one thing that I've realized is that in every rehearsal room, there's so much trauma in the room, you know, and who knows what that is. I can tell you my trauma in the room. You know, someone once said to me, Black people can never do Shakespeare because our lips are too big and our dialect is too whatever. We can't grapple with the language, right?
Holy shit.
And so that's trauma that I'll be holding on to for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And when someone casts me as Hotspur in Henry IV, right? I'm going to enter the room thinking, oh crap, what if I'm not good enough, right? What if I can't get my lips around these words, right? Everyone has trauma in the room. And that's kind of just a nature of, the world we live in, the racism, the sexism, the prejudice. Okay. But now, can we acknowledge that trauma and do better and do more responsibly in navigating every person in the room? Because if not, then we're just exacerbating the trauma. I saw an interview of the actors in Judas and the Black Messiah. You know, they talked about just the experience of taking on those roles, and one actor said, it would be nice to have a psychologist, a professional mm-hmm. on the production team, so that when we're dealing with either the subject matter of the play is traumatic or whatever we're bringing it is bubbling up something traumatic from inside of us, right? Mm-hmm. It would be nice to have someone to talk to. Yeah. And then even working with the griot, with the Black Classical Acting Ensemble, we talked about the idea of storytelling. And sort of the alushi are sort of these ancient elements that make up the world, right? They're the air, the water, the soul, the celestial, et cetera, et cetera. And depending on what character you're playing, you take on one of the alush or several of the alushi. You take them into you, and that helps you create the character, right? And at the end of the story, there's ritual you have to do to exercise that alushi back out of you, right? So that you can go back to being yourself. And I think that's a business person might hear that and say, what alushi? What is he talking about, right? But I think regardless of your religion or your spirituality or whatever you believe in, right, there's something true to that, right? When we go into the business of storytelling, we're taking on these characters and their lives and their ideas, right? And it's good to be able to responsibly let go of all of that at the end of the process. That's something they don't teach you in school.
No, but it's so necessary.
Yeah. And so anyway, you know, the moral of the story is how can we more responsibly go into the business of theater making, recognizing everyone's trauma and recognizing what everyone in the room needs to tell this story effectively so that it's not harmful to the self.
Yeah, I love that. And I wish more places embodied that. I work, all of my work in theater is based as a dramaturg. So when I go into a room, I'm working from a place of what do you need, mostly for my playwrights, but it also comes for performers too. So it just means a lot to hear other people consider that as well, because there's so much that we carry into a room and then so much that you end up leaving with a room. That like I have my ways of taking care of myself when I leave a room. And I know I work with my playwrights, but there's a specific barrier that I have and I'm supposed to have where I can't get to do that for performers. And I just don't always see whether or not they're cared for in that way, depending on like who's in the room with me as a director. No, that's really great work. But
Yeah, I
like
mean
to pivot a little.
it's important.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I just there's so much great work you do in theater, but you're also an educator, and I think some of what you're talking about, some of where you're coming from in this place of need and like and also how you enter and leave a room, I feel like comes from a place of teaching and education. So I wanted to know a little bit about your background as a teacher as well.
Sure. I've been teaching acting since 2010. So there's 11 years right now. I started as a in grad school. We earned our fellowship by teaching intro to acting classes. So I started off you know being thrown into the deep end teaching intro to acting and then also teaching a class called Gay Plays, which was a sort of dramatic literature analysis of queer plays you know throughout history.
That sounds amazing.
I loved it. And now that I've seen several theater programs, I realized that you know UNLV was a little ahead of the game
Oh, yeah.
with the options that they had for people because we had a gay plays class, we had a women's playwrights class, we had a black playwrights class. And then you know we had basic theater history, and then we had American modern realism, and then we had contemporary, and then we had a sort of absurdist playwrights class, right? So you know there was a whole lot of options to learn about that I don't think a lot of people get, but
No, that's thorough.
yeah, there you have it. And then after you, well, I also spent some time teaching at an acting studio that kind of prepares young actors for going on to Disney or Nickelodeon or what have you, because Vegas is
Oh,
right
wow.
there in the midst of all of that. So I taught
Yeah.
at that studio as well. And then I left Vegas. I worked around the country for a little bit as an actor. And then eventually found myself back here in Maryland. And I started teaching at UMBC. And then off and on, I also teach at George Washington University down in DC.
Yeah.
And then my work with Chesapeake Shakespeare Company has been as the director of the studio, which is the studio is our small sort of in-house school, and we offer programming for youth, adults, internships for college students, sort of continuing education for older students, a program for military veterans, and now the Black Classical Acting Ensemble has also kind of developed out of the studio. But just a sort of an educational, I don't want to say institution, because that sounds like it sounds evil, right? But sort of an educational program,
yeah,
to bring Shakespeare and the classics to Baltimore.
No, that's amazing. I had, so in PG County, at least where with my school, we had a connection with the DC Shakespeare Theater. So that was my start, was
great,
like classical and Shakespeare and that. So I, yeah, all of this, like this bridge of like, cause PG County is also majority Black, of like this bridge of like, mm-hmm, classic, but also like making sure that it can fit the students and like the body of that community,
yeah,
was a big part of my like foundational work in theater.
And where'd you go to school?
I went to Flowers, Charles Herbert Flowers, Mecca of Excellence.
Oh, we went to the same high school.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, this is amazing.
get out of town.
What class are you?
2006.
Oh my God, you were like 2 years behind my brother. My brother, my sister, and I all went to Flowers.
Wow.
Oh,
wow.
So you know Miss Jones.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I do.
She was divine.
Miss Jones is the reason I went to college, because I, you know, there was a point where I was like, do I need that? Mm-hmm. And she was like, yes. Yes.
Yeah. That's why I made that sound. I was like, I'm sure that didn't slide very long.
No, she was no, she didn't play around.
She's very serious. My brother's biggest memory of Miss Jones and her presence that like lives in her family is he was doing something in the hallway he wasn't supposed to do, and Miss, uh-huh, Jones, she was a large woman with a very big,
yep,
presence, and she just put her hand on the top of his head. And he just got sent in a direction from that motion. And he never stepped out of line again. I think he and Miss Jones had a nice little happy relationship after that.
Wow. That's crazy. Look at that.
It's such a small world.
Yeah. Well, you know, I went to get the first COVID vaccine a couple of weeks, mm-hmm, ago. And I was on the wrestling team at Flowers, and
oh, okay,
I still wear my wrestling sweatshirt. And I was wearing it when I went to get this vaccine, and the woman that gave me the vaccine, she's like, "Oh, you went to Flowers?"
Mm-hmm.
I say, yeah, a long time ago. And she's like, "Oh yeah, I know Flowers. I'm from PG County." I'm like, "Wow, small world."
It's always so immediate when you connect with someone else from PG, and you're just like, "What school did you go to? Where? What part of PG?" and things like that. Like, I'm from,
yep,
the area by Six Flags, so I'm just,
okay,
like, "Where is everybody else at? Where are we at?"
Yep. I grew up. So I grew up down, you know where. Where Forestville Park Mall is?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I lived down in that area, but I was in the science and tech program.
Yeah, so was
which
I!
Is, which is why, yeah. Do they still have that? Or?
They do, yeah. I was a,
okay.
So this is interesting, because I was really wondering how you ended up with a BA in neuroscience, which is so specific.
Yeah.
And now it's starting to track a little bit. So yeah, Flowers has this like science and tech program that, mm-hmm, is... You know, it's really just for other students from like outside of the area to be able to like kind of like major, I guess, a little bit in either like engineering, computer science, or biology. And I don't,
yep,
know if this was true when you were there, but bio was the track for like anybody who didn't really actually want to do like science and tech, but was there so that way they could go to Flowers as like their school. So bio was my track, because I was like, I don't know anything about engineering and I can't do computer science.
Well, you know, I was just always good at math. You know,
Oh,
I could
see,
do
that's different.
addition, you know, all that crap. So I went to you know, I got into the science and tech program, and you know, I had already taken algebra or whatever back in middle school. So I was like in the I was in the junior level math class. And I think because of that, the advisor, Mr. Sharif, was he there when
Mr.
you were
Sharif is
there?
still there.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr.
Yeah.
Sharif was one of my teachers.
Mr. Sharif was like the advisor of the science and tech program.
Okay.
And I think he was like, okay, well, yeah, you should do engineering. But I hated
It
engineering. Oh my God. I was just we had to do this project where we like built a mouse trap out of
Yes,
paper.
I remember.
And you had to like trap the whatever it was in the mouse trap, and then the teacher would like spin it and it had to not fall out. And coming up with the design of that little contraption was like, I loathed it. So I was like, no, I don't want to do engineering. Just throw me in into biology, please.
Yeah, that's exactly how it goes. No, the engineering track was so serious. They had to build so many things. There was like the robotics classes and teams that they had to do. I did not envy my engineering friends. I was like, just give me the environmental science classes. Teach me about whatever this needs to be. I will learn whatever I need to learn about the human body, but just don't make me build anything. Just don't make me build something. It's gonna go bad. We were supposed to build like a catapult, I think, for one of our like intro classes. And me and my partner just like, we didn't know what to do. I just remember gluing a battery to a piece of wood as like a weight. I don't know how I passed that class. I don't know.
It's interesting, like that we ended up in the arts, because I mean, there's so much problem solving that happens just like being an artist
Exactly.
and figuring out, oh, how am I going to make this work? And it's crazy that I hated, you know, that type of problem solving back in high school, but now here I am doing it all the time.
All of our teachers are somewhere laughing manically at what you just said because that's exactly what I got told my 4 years of being there because everyone knew I was not there to do any of the work they wanted me to do. And they're like, this is gonna be useful. And now here I am like drafting plans for things and like building ideas of how to problem solve, exactly like you said. It's just you can never escape it. They're not wrong about that, and I don't like it. But how did you end up in, you talked to Miss Jones. Miss Jones set you on a path and said, no, you gotta go to school. How did neuroscience end up being the thing that you got your degree in?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly why neuroscience, but I remember getting accepted to Johns Hopkins, and I had a pretty decent financial aid package. And I think there was a conversation of, okay, well, yeah, if you go to Hopkins, what are you going to study? And I remember Ben Carson, because this is old school Ben Carson. But I had his autobiography, and Ben Carson did his graduate study at Hopkins in neuroscience. And I was like, ooh, I'm gonna be the next Ben Carson. That's what I'm gonna do. So, you know, I was like, okay, well, I'll go to Hopkins and I'll study neuroscience and I'll be the next Ben Carson. Granted, this was 2006, so you know, nobody knew what would happen 10 years
The
later,
times
but
have
there we
changed.
are. So I went to Hopkins, and you know, I was taking my prerequisites, and my career counselor at Hopkins said, "Hey, you know what? You're taking all of these science and math, and I was a Spanish minor, so I was taking like conversational medical Spanish."
That's a class.
Yeah, or it was. Yeah,
that's incredible and so useful. Like, that's so important.
Yeah, definitely. But my advisor was like, "Why don't you take something easy? You know, you can get an easy A and you know, take a breather." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Oh yeah, good idea. I'll take an acting class because that'll just be you know so easy." And little did I know, the head of the program at Hopkins is John Aston. For those of you that don't know, John Aston is the original Gomez Adams from the Black and White Adams family. And in addition to his illustrious television career, you know, he studied with Stella Adler and Harold Klerman directly. And you know, what was part of the, I want to say, was part of that sort of early American tradition of acting that we hear about from Marlon Brando and mm-hmm. Who's the actor that I like? Can't remember his name. So, anyways, so John, you know, brought that teaching to Hopkins. And so I took an acting class, and you know, we were doing Meisner and that sort of Meisner improv stuff. I was like, wow, this is fun. Mm-hmm. You know, it's different, but I had never been challenged to like look someone in the eye and really talk to them. Mm-hmm. And I just found that so fascinating because I always thought of acting in theater as like musical theater, and yes, it's big and it's showy and it's dancing and people are singing. But this was like real life, mm-hmm, under imaginary circumstances, and I was really interested in that. So I took more classes, and then I ended up being cast in shows at the university theater and working with the student groups, and I was part of the sketch comedy team for a while. And then by the end of the 4 years at Hopkins, I kind of looked at it and said, well, you know, I've done my credits, so I might as well get my degree in neuroscience. But I think I want to be an actor. And then, you know, my mother like fell out of her chair. Yeah. And so John and Peg Dennethorne, another professor at Hopkins, you know, they told me to go to this IRTAS, which is the University Resident Acting Training Association, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's this big cattle call where all of these college students come and audition for all of these grad schools, and hopefully one grad school will like you and bring you out for free. Okay. And that's how I got hooked up with UNLV. Through IRTAS. So then I went to go get more training because, you know, Hopkins only had the minor.
Yes.
And I hadn't done any huge training. You know, mm-hmm, I wouldn't say that I was ready to go out in the real world and be an actor. So I went to go get some more training at UNLV, and then that's kind of where it all started.
That's incredible. It's always fun for me to hear how actors get involved because, I mean, like, just there's such a connection to performance. And literally, my acting class was the reason I almost dropped my theater major. It was
really,
yes. I straight up did not want to do it. I dropped it my first semester and I like really reconsidered whether or not. I was like, I don't know if I want to do this major if this is a requirement. And obviously, I stuck with it. But like, legitimately, that one class was a stopping point for me.
Yeah, you know, I think different strokes for different folks. I think if I had started off in like a like a directing class or like a theater management class, I would have been like, oh
It
no.
shapes you so differently. But I love that, and that's a really that's such a fascinating path to take into it. And like you said, it's different strokes for different folks all the time. Everyone has a different way in. But I do want to talk about a little bit about your interests. And the one thing that stuck out to me, probably because my father has a very, very extensive record collection. You love old things. What are some of the records you own? What are some of the records you're looking forward to, or we're looking forward to? Like, what's music clearly seems to be an interest.
So I only get a record if it's something old. So I don't buy like, you know,
No, like new vinyl.
like I
No.
I'm not interested in that. But I have like, you know, Mumford and Sons, the Mamas and Papas, the Elton John collection sitting over there. I've got The Miseducation of Lauryn
Oh, that's
Hill.
amazing.
You know, th things that I feel like music, you know, when we're looking at the 50s and 60s into the 70s, all the way to the early 90s even, I feel like music just had this sound that you can't replicate on a cell phone, right? I love hearing, you know, the crackle of the silence. I've got just like a one-winged bird. Who is that? Sends no, sends like she's singing. Oh, thank you. I've got a Stevie Nicks album, and her voice just echoes through, you know, this little record player. And I just you just can't hear that on a computer and on the digital master. So, you know, I love, you know, the sound that kind of gets muffled and digitized when you're listening on a computer. But you can really hear that on the records.
No, I love that. This is also a good reminder that I need to buy my dad a new record player. He's been sad since ours broke. Thank you for reminding me of
Oh
that. No, there's just, yeah, there's something so fascinating about the way, and my dad's favorite thing about records, and this is like one of the things that I picked up, is he just loves the ability to flip it. Like the fact that you run through one
no.
side and then you flip it, that has always struck a chord with me, is like, you know, you have to arrange it according to sides too. Like it's a complete album, but then there's also that split in the middle of like how long the side has to be, how much you can fit on that one side, and what one side is versus the other side. And that's always really, you know, that sort of like that creation of a thing, that like curation of it is a really great aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, record producers also had to be storytellers, you know? Like, what's the order of these tracks, and what's going to be on side A, what's going to be on side B, and how is that going to tell the overall story of the album? You know, I think I think we still do that in different ways today. But you know, I love watching there was this Temptations movie that came out back in the day, and there's a scene where they're sitting around listening to a Temptation song, and Berry Gordy is like, okay, if you only had a dollar in your pocket, would you buy this album or would you spend it on a hamburger? And if the room said hamburger, then the album didn't go. Right. And they had to go back to the drawing board. And I think, you know, that there's some real work in putting together the story of the album that we don't always appreciate.
No, I think that's so true. And it is, like I said, my work is based in dramaturgy, and storytelling is that's like my heart and soul. So just the way in which it permeates through so many different art forms, and especially music, especially when you think of it on that like cohesive aspect, is it just strikes a chord with me. I love that.
Yeah.
But let's talk about a little bit something that I know was personal to you, Casey Cares Foundation. So you chose that as the organization that we're going to support. We'll be collecting donations for it through the month of March. And Casey Cares, they have a really amazing mission, but I want to hear from you, why you chose this, how you found out or got involved with this organization, and what it means to you.
Yeah, so I know of Casey Cares because of Chesapeake Shakespeare
Okay.
Company. Every year we do a production of Christmas Carol, and a portion of the proceeds of Christmas Carol goes to Casey Cares to support the Tiny Tims out there that are going through hardships and their families to allow them to get through. So I've always, admired that mission and admired the organization. They have a kind of a sub organization, and I can't remember exactly, but it's specifically for like getting groceries to certain families that might be struggling while their child is going through treatment. And so I've always been into that. I'm also a big wrestling fan. I love professional wrestling, and they the WWE does this thing every year where when they induct Hall of Famers, when they induct legends into the Hall of Fame, they also choose, one sort of special person that has been fighting through some sort of hardship. They've had cancer survivors, or youth that are going through brain neurological conditions and et cetera, et cetera. It's called a Connor's Cure, because the original inductee was this young man who had a brain tumor, and his name was Connor, and he passed away. And then in honor of him, because he was a huge wrestling fan, right? And so in honor of him, they induct, a new Connor every year. And so, I just admire organizations that are attempting to give back to younger people that, might be going through several different hardships. I think, this is very cliche, but right, the children are our future, and teach them well and let them lead the way. But seriously, I think there's value in giving back to the next generation. And I think that that's valuable in so many different ways. But I think when we have individuals in the next generation that are going through hardship, organizations like Casey Cares are so valuable to them and their families. And so that's why I chose Casey Cares, and that was my interest in it.
Yeah, that's really great. And Casey Cares, really, they have such a broad spectrum of how they provide support to these families that are going through such a critical time. So it's really exciting to get to know what they're doing, because like you said, there's the grocery programs, and then they have other programs that are just about, uplifting the spirit of that family, whether it's birthday parties or, movie activities. So they looked at a problem, looked at where people were struggling, and then decided not to have one solution. They decided to have many. And I think that that's a really beautiful way to go about that. So we're excited at GCC to be able to provide some support to Casey Cares Foundation. And I'm looking forward to getting to know their work a little bit more, and hopefully our listeners will also be interested. You can find our information on our website and find out more about this foundation and what they're doing and the ways that you can help, because like I said, there's always more than just donations that an organization needs. So check out their site and see what else they can use for your help, y'all.
Perfect.
Thanks, Gerard, for being here today. It's been really amazing to talk with you. And this was a great conversation. I think all of our guests should be from PG County now, but that's probably not allowed. But next time we do have someone very, very special, Katie Nolan, who is an ESPN correspondent, Emmy nominated at that, will be with us. And so next time we might get into a little bit of sports and art. And I can't wait for that conversation. So that'll be next week with Katie Nolan, y'all. But for now, thanks for listening. And Gerard, thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.